Turning to John, the Gospel according to John in chapter 11. The central part of this chapter, I believe, is Jesus' words in verse 25, "I am the resurrection and the life." It is striking that in the light of such words, in the first half of the story, we read how Jesus let Lazarus die. He did not deny that he could have prevented Lazarus' death. Both Lazarus' sisters said to him, "You could have prevented it." He did not deny that. He did not deny that he could have prevented it if he had dropped everything he had been doing and gone to Bethany straight away. But we read in that first part that from the moment he heard that his friend was sick, he knew what it was all about, and that his main concern was that all of these things, everything that happened in this episode, had to be first of all for God's glory, and that through that the Son of God himself would also be seen in his glory. It's because of that that he did not act just on the basis of what everyone else could see. We discover that Jesus understood things very differently. Bear that in mind as we go on into the latter part of this episode as well. Jesus then did set out. 2 days later, he set out for Bethany, but he knew the timing that he would arrive well after the death of Lazarus. He knew when Lazarus had died, in fact. It's after he arrived at Bethany that we find out just how that sickness of Lazarus was for the glory of God, as he had said in verse 4. Jesus made a claim for himself. There in Bethany, it was put to the test. Was not put to the test just at the last day, as Martha referred to in verse 24, but it was put to the test then and there, right in front of them. As he does so often, at least as John records it, these are the primary points, touch points in the Gospel of John. There were claims that Jesus made, who he is. There were incidents around it that reinforced that claim, and this is one of them. And this time, it is perhaps the largest, the most far-reaching of claims that he does make. He says, "I am the life. I am the resurrection and the life." And then immediately proceeds to demonstrate that his claim is true. People of Jesus' day, they were expecting the great prophet that was to come from Israel. Moses had promised that this would happen back in Deuteronomy 18. But Moses, with that, and he spoke generally about prophets and certainly about this great prophet, he said, "You will know that he is true when his words come true. When he says something will happen, and it does happen." And for many of the Old Testament prophets, it is found by the end of the Old Testament that their words were true. We do know that they were true prophets because their words did come about. We know it especially when we come to the Gospels, as their words were fulfilled in Jesus. Their words were true. That point of proof that Moses set before them was the great test, and these prophets tested true. But you find that as well with Jesus. You find it all the more so with Jesus. Jesus said what he would do, and especially at this time, almost immediately his promise comes true. But it is a promise. It's not after the event what he says. It is something before that he says, "Your brother will rise again," in verse 23. "I am the resurrection and the life." First, it's worth bearing in mind, there was another incident that Mark tells us of where there were four men brought their friend to be healed by Jesus, and he first of all forgives sin, something that cannot be seen by the natural eye of man. But then he goes on to say, but so that you will know that I have the authority to forgive sin, rise up and walk. I will do something that shows I have this authority. He could claim, I'm the resurrection and the life. But how do we know? Your brother will rise again. Now let's go to the tomb. This is the succession by which he demonstrates that his claim for himself is true. Or you could put it the other way. He says to her, to Martha first, your brother will rise again. How did he know that? He is absolutely certain this will happen. So is Martha in one sense. But Jesus is saying, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about right now. But his certainty of that is based upon what he knows he is himself. It's because that he is the resurrection and the life that he could tell Martha, your brother will rise again. What do we have here then, particularly in the latter parts? Last week we spent some time looking at the first part leading up to this arrival at the tomb. But as we come to that, as we look around it, what do we have here showing how Jesus responded to the events because he is the resurrection and the life? And I would say that there are three main areas that we should give attention to as he responds to this death. There are these words. We've referred to some of them in introduction. His words, they are against death. We also see his weeping, that famous verse. Jesus wept, his weeping. It is also against death. Then we see what he did, working against death. He is the resurrection and the life. He is against death, and he does it in his words, in his weeping, and in his works, in his working. First of all, then, his words. Let's dwell on this for a moment. I think when we do go back to the beginning of the story, we can detect that there is a sympathy in Jesus' heart for the people around him. He said to his disciples as they heard, and even the messengers from the sisters of Lazarus, Jesus said, this sickness is not unto death. And at face value, this suggests that he has a sympathy, that he knows that death is a painful thing. And it was very comforting to the people around him to hear that Lazarus was sick, but he was not going to die from his sickness. At least that's how it first appeared. And I say this because it is common to all men that death is a reason for sadness, for pain, for sorrow. When it happens to someone whom you know, when you're close to someone, at least. As we read on, then we come and we see that there's a suggestion that Jesus' intention is to reverse the condition that Lazarus was in. I put it that way especially because in verse 11 we read that our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up. He's going to reverse what Lazarus was, his condition at that moment. Jesus was going to turn it around. Now that sounds, again, fine at face value. But underneath it, Jesus knew that Lazarus was dead, as we call it, dead. But he says, I'm going to wake him up. I'm going to bring him out of that death. That's what Jesus was talking about, although it was understood differently by the people around him. In this case, at least, he knew that it was for the best that Lazarus should be brought back from the dead. But of course, in all of this, never forget that the whole purpose of these events was already stated by him, that it was for the glory of God and that the Son of God may be glorified through it. And that had to be said, because that's not the way that people usually think of death. This was not something that was commonly said. Lazarus is dead. To God be the glory. Lazarus is dead. Let's howl and wail for a week. It had to be said. Whatever happens from here on through this sickness of Lazarus, it is for the glory of God. And it's still the way. You know, one of the common objections to the Christian faith and to God himself, there's no logic to it, but one of the common objections is that look at all this suffering in the world. It's a companion of death, and most of it is death in the end. Look at it all, and it doesn't fit with their idea of what God is and who God is. People cannot see the connection between death and the glory of God. It had to be said by Jesus that this death, this sickness, was for the glory of God. When Jesus did come, he was very decisive to stay for 2 days. He was decisive when he knew that Lazarus was dead. And he came, and he met with Martha, not in the village. She had come, she knew, had heard that he was on his way. He met with Martha, and he promised to her that her brother's death would be overturned once again, that this his work against death, even just in this particular instance. And this was then followed by further and universal words that are universally applicable, not just for the case of Lazarus. This is the key statement. I'm saying words against death. What could be more powerfully against death, more directly opposed to death, than for him to say, I am the resurrection and the life? He's identifying himself on the side of life, not death. He is the life, the very source of life, standing in direct opposition. Yes, as a vicious enemy. That's what death is, and he will stand against it. Doesn't the Apostle Paul speak later of the great enemy, the last enemy, being death? But here Jesus has come amongst us, and he does elaborate on what this means. I am the resurrection and the life. And he says there are two possibilities for man. One is that a man might die, but he shall live if he believes in Jesus. Verse 25. And then verse 26 is the other possibility. There are only two. Whether you die or whether you continue to live. Whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. But both of these possibilities, that he shall live, that he shall never die, they rest on whether you believe in Jesus. He doesn't elaborate any further than that. Perhaps the precise meaning might not be fully understood from what he says here. I've already referred, speaking with the children, about John chapter 3. There he spoke to Nicodemus. And he stresses there several times that what really matters, this life that he is most concerned about, this eternal life, is a spiritual thing. That's his primary purpose. And that is what's behind this. You may die as everyone looks at it, die as everyone sees it, that requires a funeral and all of those things. But even so, you may live if you believe in him. But it's not complete death. Think about Lazarus for a minute. We only have this story. He's referred to by name a couple of times to follow, but just this one story about him. And the story concludes, remember, with him coming out of the grave. And it stops there. We have what matters. But we only ever read of the first death of Lazarus. We have to assume that he did die, as we call it, again, because we all do. But you would hope that having gone through this experience, Lazarus himself would indeed believe in Jesus, and that whatever follows need not hold any fears for him. Believing in Jesus, the resurrection and the life, if he can do this, he will complete it. He will keep me from complete death, where our bodies may die, will die, but not our souls. The Bible talks about being hurt by the second death. In Revelation, it's used three times, this term, the second death. And it's talking about when someone is completely separated from God in body and soul. Revelation 20 verse 6 says, "Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power." I think it's when we read this that it also opens up to us what Jesus meant even at the beginning when he said, "This sickness is not unto death." At the material, the physical level, which we all too often are absorbed with, it was unto death. And he knew that was what was going to happen. That's why he stayed for 2 days. He did know that he was intending to raise Lazarus in body, but surely he was far more concerned about the kinds of sickness that lead to complete death. That's his preoccupation. This sickness, it's not unto death. It is a sickness of body which leads to the body dying. But it's not the great sickness that leads to true death, complete death. It's not the sickness that he had come to take away, the sickness of sin. The disciples, Mary, Martha, the people all around them, they managed to concern themselves with the sickness of the body. Lazarus sleeps. The disciples said, "If he sleeps, he will get well." They could not see beyond it. Who can? Unless the Spirit of God leads us to understand. But as Jesus said another time, in another context, he said, "Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. But rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." That's the death that he's concerned about. That's the death that he had come to deal with. That's the death he had come to overturn as the resurrection and the life. But to demonstrate that he is dealing with spiritual things, that he had a right to this great claim, he claimed that he promised that he would do something that they could see as well. Jesus claimed high. He promised as well something very hard to believe. Martha doesn't really answer that she did believe. She's evasive. She talks about the last day. Well, okay, you might say that he'll rise again, but let's not go too far. I know he'll rise again at the last day. She doesn't answer. She doesn't respond directly to the belief that he's calling from her, that he is the resurrection and the life. She does acknowledge that he is a great person. He is the Christ, the Son of God. But she's expecting more to come. Does she believe? Does anyone believe that her brother would rise again? What would be the next step? But before we get to the event of the resurrection of Lazarus, there is something else that is important for us to see, and that is that Jesus wept, and what that means. It's good that the young people enjoy this verse and remember it. We all could do with remembering it. But as I said to them, let's try and understand what is going on here, to remember it for the right reasons. Jesus asked, "Where have you laid him?" They invited him to come and to see. We read a little further that the tomb was a cave and a stone lay against it, much as Jesus' own tomb was not so long after this, and many were at the time. Jesus was invited to see, and he went. All the time he was surrounded by not only Mary and Martha, but there were the women around them, and it seems like sometimes culturally there would be a special group of women who would get about those who were grieving, were bereaved, and they would work up a mourning and a wailing around it. And that's what was going on. And many others had joined them as well, the Jews, we read. Surrounded by weeping. John tells us Jesus' response to this in verse 33 is that he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. In his own heart, in his own spirit, there was a groaning. There was an agony. And Jesus' weeping in verse 35 is associated with this. There are some things that perhaps are not as clear in our translation. I'm not sure about other languages, but we're a bit limited. But it hints in the right direction to remember, to be taken back. That weeping is not just as the people looking on around him thought, see how he loved him. It's not just that Jesus was weeping over losing a great friend. It wasn't his own grief over that single loss. But it seems to be in connection with all that's going on around him. And especially reflected in that culture of weeping that was going on. And that groaning in spirit, that trouble of spirit, is like a great distress, a tearing apart. There's a great wrestling going on inside him. It is a major thing. And it would suggest that it is this, the attitude that's conveyed, the response to death that is going on in the people around him. But this also, it's a much more extensive thing that this troubles him. After his own resurrection, Jesus met with two disciples who didn't recognize him, and they were troubled in spirit. Just a few words he says to them. He calls them slow of heart to believe. And it seems to be this that is already present, is lingering amongst people. He's asked them, "Will you believe? Martha, will you believe? I'm saying this, will you believe?" A couple of verses later, 37, some people said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?" Some people are inching towards believing. They're seeing he's doing mighty things already. Martha and Mary, they had been close to him. They had been hearing his words. Would they believe? Who would believe? You're slow of heart to believe. Isn't this a pain, an anguish of spirit? This was the great distress to Jesus. He'd come to save men, to give them life in the Spirit. All they needed to do was to believe, to have put their faith in him. And through all his great promises, so far, they could only look on the gap that was left by a man who had died. It seems to me that it's hardly changed since then. There are so many terribly confused ideas around death. In our own culture, in our own society, there's a terrible mix-up. But there's a great desire that that will not be the end. You find it in most cultures. It really does rock man to the foundations when someone dies. And the reality of death itself, Jesus, the resurrection and the life, staring death in his face. The reality of death itself. And all that confusion around death, what is it all about? When the truth is available, that there is a way of life, and that should still cause all who love Christ great distress, trouble of spirit. In his spirit. Jesus did weep, but it was not just weeping. Surely it was not just weeping over the loss of a friend. It is a grieving thing. It is a painful thing. But this was on account of the vast, much vaster sorrow that he had. He suffered on our account. The very reality, the presence of death amongst men. Little wonder when you remember it, he is the life. This is what grieved him. This is what tore him apart. To see that man, the world that he so loved, man could not see through. He was pleading with them, will you believe? Will you believe? And all they could think to do was to go on weeping in the right way. He wept against death. Because he is the life. But it's striking too, I think, that it's not just that he is the life, he is also the giver of life. Not just the sustainer of life, but the giver. He is the resurrection. Man is heading for death. Man is only ever going that way, both physically and spiritually. And here comes the resurrection to give new life, to raise from the dead. And he works against death. Perhaps the folk around him were so absorbed and so there was such a clamor with these death wails all around them, maybe they didn't even hear properly his claims and his promises. It was so even with Mary and Martha. These huge promises. Who has ever done this before? Yes, the great prophets, Elijah and Elisha. Who else? He will rise again. How do we view these things? How do we respond when he says, I am the resurrection and the life? You might not die. You live. How do we respond? In the middle of all this, you find Jesus stepping deliberately, step by step, closer and closer, moving onwards. He makes his promise. He makes his approach. He is vulnerable. You and I couldn't say those things and keep stepping on to a closed tomb where a dead man lay. Then he acted, and his word was seen to be true. As he said in his prayer to the Father, it is that they may believe that you sent me. It wasn't just about the good of Lazarus, even that was only temporary. It wasn't just about the good and the comfort of his sisters. It wasn't just even about the good of the onlookers there and then as they saw someone brought to life in front of them. It was that they may believe that you have sent me. It's a demonstration of his power, demonstration of who he is, truly the Son of God, so that men would be led to believe in him and find eternal life. He promised before he acted. He prayed before he acted. He was setting himself up, if you like, for the most brutal tearing down. He was setting himself up for the harshest possible assessment by all who did hear and see him. But he did it with complete confidence because he is the resurrection and the life. He did what he said he would do. He brought Jesus out of the grave. He knew who he was himself, and he moved without hesitation to this mighty miracle. I think it's very instructive to look over the major works that God involves himself in as he redeems man through the history of the Bible and the world. At the heart of every one of them, it's his word. It's by his word that he brought all things into being. It's by his word that he saves man. And it's this way again. You know the story? The tomb was closed. Lazarus had been buried for 4 days. Martha protests when he says, "Take the stone away." But they do it anyway because of his intention, his word of authority. How does he do it? How does he raise Lazarus? He doesn't go into the tomb. He doesn't lift the body out. He doesn't do first aid or resuscitation. He simply says from the mouth of the tomb, "Lazarus, come forth." His word. They saw the glory of God. A word of command, and a dead man obeyed. Do you hear that? A dead man obeyed the voice of Jesus. How is that possible? Except that he is indeed the resurrection and the life. That word of the life that penetrates even the death of man and brings back to life. It was the spirit that Ezekiel saw, dry bones, not fresh bones, not dead bodies, but dry bones. They'd been like that for more than 4 days. And the spirit came and they joined together and they came and they raised a great army. It's that same word that we find applied to Lazarus, "Come forth." And he who had died came out. Loose him. Let him go. With all this, if you know something of the Gospel of John, you might almost say that Jesus is here flirting with danger. He's coming closer and closer to the big, big issue. He's coming closer and closer to the real issue that he has on earth. The introduction to the Gospel, John says of Jesus that he was life. Just in the previous chapter, Jesus says, "The reason I have come is to bring life to those who follow me, the sheep." But we see here the foretaste. We see that if he is going to give life, he is the one who is stepping out to meet death head on. He did that here in a way that all men could see. And it's not long after this that he was going to have to go and meet his own death. And in answer to that, it's the same call that he gives to Martha. "Do you believe this?" Even though Jesus does not live among us today in the same way as he did then, that applies still. Do you believe this? Do you see beyond the death of the body? Do you realize that you are far more than just what is in the body? And do you go on realizing it? When you're in church, perhaps you do. When I speak to you, perhaps you do. Perhaps you're ready to admit it. But as you go out and you face all the things of daily life, do you remember that you're more than just body? Because the world will persuade you that's all you are. But through all of that, the sirens, all the noise that goes on in the city and wherever you are, through it all, will you hear, "I am the resurrection and the life"? Isn't that what is most important for you? As for conventional death, when you meet it, when you know people who are bereaved, or however you handle it, it's in the light of what Jesus has said that Paul takes it up. He said to the church in Thessalonica, "I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, or else you will sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus." That's what Jesus was calling people to. Believe in me, and then though you die, you will live. You will just be asleep, but your spirit will still be with God. And if you live, believe in me, you will never die. Yes, your body may, but you will not die. You will just sleep. Friend, hear, do you believe this? And if you have believed it, take a strong hold of it again today, because it does count for your daily life out here. We can only go so far this morning. May God set his blessing on his word among us together. Let us pray.